Yeah,
we're going live. We're going live, Alexander. We are live with Alexander Mercuris in London, and it is our honor and our great pleasure to have with us on the Duran, first time on the Duran, Professor Chang of the YouTube channel Predictive History, of which I am a huge fan of, a fantastic channel on YouTube, a fantastic professor. Professor Chang, thank you so much for joining us on the Duran, and I will have all of his channel links in the description box down below. Thank you for joining us, Professor.
Thank you.
Fantastic. So let's get started. We have a lot of ground to cover, but before we get moving, let's say a quick hello to everyone that is watching us on Odyssey, on Rockfin, on Rumble and YouTube, as well as our locals community, the Duran.locals.com, and a big shout out to our moderators as well. Thank you to our moderators in the chat. So, Alexander, Professor Chang, let's talk about predicting geopolitics.
Indeed, because we are, as everybody obviously must know, in a major geopolitical conflict situation at the present time, a geopolitical conflict which was not, in my opinion, desired by some of the parties to it. I don't think China was set out a few years ago to find itself catapulted into a geopolitical conflict. I'm absolutely sure that it didn't. The same is true with the Russians, but they are in a geopolitical conflict, and the other major player is the United States. And it is the West. And of course, all sorts of things are taking place around the world, in the Middle East, in Ukraine, in Latin America, with all these fleet movements around Venezuela. There's all kinds of events taking place in the world of economy and science and technology all the time. And all of these interconnect with each other in all sorts of ways. Now, on the Duran, what we tend to do is we tend to go through all of these topics one by one. We focus on each one and we discuss them, Alex and myself, and sometimes with our guests in detail. I think what we're going to do today with Professor Chang is something slightly different, which is we're going to try and pull these things together, perhaps looking mostly, but not exclusively, at the conflict in Europe and the developments that are taking place there, in order to try to understand where the final, where these events are leading us towards. In other words, a more predictive, a greater sense of where this is taking us. And there is no one better to do it with than Professor Chang, whose channel I should say, am a massive fan of, and which I absolutely do recommend to everybody who is viewing us as well. So, Professor Chang, let's begin. We are now, I think everybody is in agreement that we are in a global geopolitical conflict. There is a view that there are actually two completely different conflicts going on, one between Russia and the United States and the West, the other specifically between China and the United States. But they have, to some extent, merged. We've had all kinds of interactions between the Americans and the Chinese recently, and between the Russians and the Chinese. It's not been noticed so much in the West. But there are underlying trends here. There are events that are shaping how things are going. Perhaps you could take us a little bit further and discuss, shall we start with Ukraine and the conflict there, the first big war in Europe, the first war involving major clashes of armies that has taken place since the end of the Second World War. Europe has historically, in the West at least, been the pivot area. It's probably not that to anything like the same degree that it used to be. But can you perhaps give us a few thoughts about where you think this is going? Maybe looking at a bit of predictive history, if I can put it like this, you know, looking back at history, looking also perhaps at other scientific tools, which I know you're very skilled at using.
Okay, so thanks so much for having me on, Duran. I've been a big fan of your show for like 4 years now. I actually started first watching Duran when the war broke out in on February 22nd, 2022. And the reason why was all the like mainstream news coverage I was watching was like, oh my God, Ukraine's going to march to Moscow and Putin's going to fall and the Russian army is incompetent. And I couldn't believe what I was watching because it actually made no sense to me. I'm not sure if you remember the Ghost of Kiev, where you know this lone fighter jet was flying around Ukraine, just shooting on all these Russian jets. So the news coverage at that time was literally driving me insane. It made absolutely no sense to me. It was as though I was living in a bizarre world. So I scoured the internet for some actual information, and I found you guys, and like, you literally saved my life because you actually talk sense. And so I've been watching your show ever since. So basically all that I know about Ukraine comes from you guys. So if my analysis is wrong, it's your fault, not my fault. Okay? So let's just get that out of the way. But look, I am actually much more pessimistic about the situation in Ukraine than you are. I think the war is lost. I think Ukraine has ceased to function as a nation state. The wartime casualties are estimated between 1 to 2 million people. And you've got millions of Ukrainians who have fled overseas. If there's a peace treaty tomorrow, the Donbass would go to Russia. And the Donbass is the agricultural and industrial heartland of Ukraine. And so Ukraine would cease to function as a nation state. It would become a welfare state, a rump state that the Europeans would have to support. So I think the war is lost. If you just look at the situation on the front lines, the morale among Russian soldiers is extremely high. They've mastered drone warfare to an extent that no other nation can emulate. There's massive desertions among the Ukrainians. So the war is lost. But at the same time, if you just look at historical patterns, historical analogies, what you will understand is it's at this time that NATO will have no choice but to double down. NATO is going to have to come into the war. Why? Because they cannot accept the fact that they've lost. They can't go to the public and say, oh, you know, we spent hundreds of billion dollars in Ukraine. We've lost a lot of weaponry. 4 years, Putin was offering peace all this time. And we said no. And oops, we made a mistake. Sorry. They can't do that because there will be a political revolution if they did do that. Zelensky can't back down now for the same reason that if the Ukrainians ever had a chance to take a full accounting of the devastating losses these past 4 years, there would be a violent revolution in Ukraine. So NATO is forced to double down. Also, we have to remember that NATO is heavily invested in Ukraine. I mean, like they've literally assumed that when the war is over, they'll have access to all of Ukraine's rare earth minerals. That's part of their accounting. So given what's happened, it's almost like you've walked in a casino and you lost $2 million. And the casino says to you, listen, we'll take 80% and then you can just go home. Well, and then you're like, I can't go home because I have to explain this to my wife. I can't explain this to my wife. So I'm going to keep on, you know, playing, gambling, even though it might cost me my life. So I know it sounds suicidal, but it's a very dire situation for NATO and for the Europeans and for Ukraine. Ukraine is no longer functional as a nation state. And if this war ever stops, then people will come to this recognition. So I think that the truth is being hidden from us. But if you just do some macro analysis of the actual situation in Ukraine, then you can only come to the conclusion that the war is lost and the situation is far more dire than we can possibly imagine.
Let's just explore this point about NATO doubling down. I mean, what is that going to mean? Is that going to mean NATO going in and fighting the Russians in Ukraine? Because that would be an extraordinary, incredibly dangerous act of escalation. By the way, I agree with you that the war is lost. I'm not sure how long it will take for the full reality of that to hit home. But let's focus on what NATO is going to do, because NATO going on in and fighting the Russians is going to be a dramatic event, to put it mildly. I mean, it will take what is still a contained war and it would make it into an all-out European war, it would bring us much closer to the kind of situation we had in Europe between 1939 and 45. So is that where this is going? I should say that this morning I was reading in the British media that the British military are going to send all their remaining self-propelled howitzers, whatever they have left, to Ukraine to fight there, to help the Ukrainians fight there. So already we could see that there are going to be, you know, logistical challenges to doing that. But is that where they're heading? Is that what they're thinking of doing or what they might do? Because I, by the way, having had experience of people who gamble, I know exactly the psychology that you describe, that you go on piling in your chips, if I can, well, I don't gamble myself, but you go on doing that because you lose more and more and more and more. But you say to themselves, if I do it just a little bit further, the luck will turn, the wheel will turn, and I'll get it all back. So is that what they're going to do?
I don't think NATO has strategic foresight. If they did, they would not have gotten themselves in this situation in the first place, right? So we have to remember that, and Putin has said this, NATO has been fighting Russia in Ukraine for the past 4 years anyway, because even though it's Russia, it's Ukrainian manpower, it is NATO weaponry, NATO intelligence, NATO special forces, NATO command and control, NATO targeting. So you know, when these bridges get blown up in Crimea, it's not Ukraine that's doing this, it's NATO that's doing this, right? All these deep strikes into Russia, that's NATO. Ukraine doesn't have the expertise, the personnel, the weaponry to do this. It's all NATO. So NATO has been fighting anyway. So what we're seeing right now is a gradual mission creep. And so, listen, the reality is we already have NATO mercenaries, NATO special forces, NATO officers on the ground in Ukraine. It's an open secret. So you just have mission creep. You just have a gradual expansion of this. And then what I think will happen is that eventually you get a point where NATO decides that the front lines cannot be held. You know, Pervols has fallen. 10,000 Ukrainians have been encircled. The front lines cannot be held right now. So what you do is you make Odessa your final stand. You make Odessa the Stalingrad of this war. And that's where I think the final battle will be. The issue for NATO right now is they don't have the manpower necessary to make a final stand. So eventually they'll be forced to have a draft. You know, Romania has already discussed the possibility of drafting young men. This creates a problem for NATO because their governments are not very popular back in Europe. You have massive migration that is weakening the social contract, that is weakening social cohesion. It seems as though France and Britain are almost on the verge of civil war right now. So it's a very delicate situation for NATO. On one hand, they need to draft soldiers for this war in Ukraine that they cannot afford to lose. On the other hand, it's possible these soldiers mutiny at some point. So I don't think NATO knows what it's doing. I don't think NATO has a strategic plan moving forward. At the same time, it's a gambler's mentality where you're just forced to move in more and more chips, even though it's impossible to recover your losses right now.
It's not just Romania that's talking of reintroducing the draft. Germany is doing the same. And I know Germany very well. And I know that the mood amongst young Germans is very, very hostile to that idea. And I do think that if there was an attempt to do that and to try and send young men from Europe to fight in Ukraine, I think there would be a very, very strong reaction, very much in the line with what you have suggested. Now, let's just look through this. The Europeans send troops to fight in Odessa. There is a Stalingrad-type battle there. They're up against a much, much more experienced Russian army. Their troops are unwilling. There's probably major discontent and disaffection in Europe. It's not easy to see this battle being won against the Russians. It seems to me like a recipe for disaster if we ever get there. And what does the United States do in that situation?
Right. So I think NATO is doing this because the United States is forcing it to do this. I think if it were up to Europeans, there would be no war. Remember, Germany relies on cheap Russian gas. This war does not benefit Europe in any way. In fact, you can make the argument that, after 2014, the Europeans have basically been screwed over by the Americans, right? This is something that America is forcing upon NATO. And quite honestly, it doesn't really matter, America, if NATO falls, right? Because it's all the way up in Europe. And this is why we're seeing such idiotic decision-making, because for the Americans, it's like, who really cares? I mean, we decided to fight Russia to last Ukrainian. Now we're going to fight Russia to last European. Is there really a difference from our perspective? All we need to do is bog Russia down, you know? And if this war keeps on dragging, there's a possibility that the Russian economy collapses. And in fact, Americans are absolutely confident that eventually the Russian economy will buckle under American sanctions, even though there's absolutely no evidence this is the case. In fact, we're seeing a resurgence in the Russian economy. But the problem in Washington, D.C. is they are so removed from the actual reality and the consequences of this reality that they are making really silly decisions. I mean, the idea is that, well, you know, if you keep on fighting Russia and Ukraine, eventually Russia will tire itself out. But it's like saying to you, okay, it's like saying, well, you know, I'm gonna box someone, and this person works out every day, but I won't work out because, you know, he'll work out every day and he'll just exhaust himself. So when the actual fight happens, and I'll just knock him down because, like, I'm well rested, you know, and like he's not. Okay, it's like this is American decision making has never ever been strategic, has never been clairvoyant. So I don't see America doing much in this situation.
Isn't this a little bit like what happened at the end of the Chinese War, the war between the Communist Party of China, the People's Liberation Army, and the Kuomintang? Because yeah. you had the defeat of the Kuomintang, and they went to Taiwan, and then very shortly after, you had the Korean War, and the Americans assumed that they would be able to go into Korea, and they got all their allies to fight in Korea, and they completely discounted the possibility that China might intervene. I've read this history. I know this history very, very well. And then, of course, China does intervene, and it comes as a profound and complete shock. Even at that point, they're not able to think strategically or have any capacity to understand that the other side, and China at that time did not particularly want, by the way, to be the other side, but it became that the other side would have to react to what it saw as a major strategic and security challenge to itself. This inability to think strategically actually has a very, very long, deep roots in the United States.
Look, I mean, it's not just not being able to think strategically. I mean, there's also some racism involved as well, right? So if you look at the documents and you look at what MacArthur, you know, who was Supreme Commander of Allied Forces in Korea, what he was thinking, he was just basically thinking, you know, the Chinese are cowards. The Chinese aren't going to risk a fight. Chinese are afraid of dying. So he had absolute contempt for the Chinese army. And that's why his American forces were overextended in Korea. They were easily encircled by Chinese forces. I mean, if you talk to any American historian, they'll tell you that the Chinese army in Korea fought with extreme bravery, fought with extreme strategy. They outmaneuvered, encircled the American forces, and it was a miracle that the Americans were able to retreat in order. Yeah, so I don't think it's just like lack of foresight. It's also deep contempt for other nations as well.
But that's no different with the Russians, because
Exactly. Back to what you were saying,
I mean, contempt, that they're incompetent, that they're inefficient, and all of those things.
I have a lot of American friends, and they all tell me, you know, there's a entrenched Russophobia in Washington, D.C. There's a deep contempt. There's a deep fear of Russia, and it's never gone away, not even after the end of the Cold War. It's still there.
Let's just then discuss what happened. So the Europeans go in, the Americans push them, tell them to go in. It
yep.
turns into a military debacle, because I have to say that seems to me far and away the most likely outcome. It also turns into a major political crisis in Europe, and you talked about the economic instabilities. I'd say Europe is much more unstable economically at this particular point in time than Russia is. I know that's a view that many people would challenge, but that is my own view. Let's assume that I am right. We have a massive crisis in Europe. That might call into question the entire existence of NATO, or am I missing something?
Look, so the closest historical analogy is the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta. And if you read Thucydides, what he tells you is that the war was not really between Athens and Sparta. It was really between Athens and its allies, because Athens was exploiting the resources of its allies, sending its allies to these pointless wars. And eventually, its allies would switch sides and join Sparta because Athens was so oppressive. So if that's a guide, then we can expect that eventually Europeans are going to figure out, you know what, is Russia really our enemy, or is America our enemy, right? Because the Russians are offering peace. The Russians have told us that they're not going to invade. And like, why would you ever think that Putin has intentions of invading? Whereas America, you know, it blew up our Nord Stream pipeline. It sank our economies. It's forcing us to buy really expensive American liquefied gas. It's going to force us into this pointless, unwinnable war in Ukraine. They are imposing tariffs on us to drain our economy further. So who's our enemy right now? Is Russia our enemy, or is America our enemy? I think eventually they'll come to the conclusion that they're actually better off with Russia than they are with America. I don't know how long it'll take, but I think if the Peloponnesian War is a guide, then that's the end result.
As a Greek and an Athenian, a very old Athenian, I can absolutely confirm what you've just said. In fact, Athens came to be called the Tyrant City. And when it was finally defeated, there was calls from Athens' former allies that the city be completely expunged from the earth. And it was the Spartans who said no.
Yeah.
They actually spoke out against it. Okay, so we have a situation. Again, let's explore this. We have a situation where the European allies finally rebel, not under the present leadership, but under alternative leaderships, which is far from inconceivable, by the way. And we have a dramatic change in Europe's attitudes. Where does that leave the United States? Because I'm going to suggest something. I know a lot of Americans. John Mearsheimer is one, and he's somebody I've come to know very well. He says that, you know, the United States doesn't need Europe. Europe is problematic place. I think that would be true if the United States were to follow a policy of peace and internal construction and development. But a United States that continues to be wedded to geopolitical ambitions, I mean, it will have lost its key allies. I mean, surely that will weaken it, not strengthen it.
So go back to the Peloponnesian War, right? Remember that Athens was not only fighting enemies overseas, Sparta, and Sicily, Syracuse. It was also fighting an internal civil war, right? So there was a coup d'etat in Athens by the elite, and then there was a rebellion by sailors. So internal Athenian politics was just completely bonkers, right? You had people like Cleon, Alcibiades. They were demagogues, and they were causing lots of problems internally. So I think why Athens was defeated was not because it faced a superior foe in Sparta. It collapsed because of this internal infighting. And I think that's what's happening in the United States right now. I mean, like, let's go to the United States. There's the government is shut down. I'm not sure people recognize this, but the government is shut down. It's possible when next month you have tens of millions of Americans starving because they don't have access to food stamps, and no one seems to care. Donald Trump doesn't really seem to care. And, you know, there's talk of a civil war in the United States. And I think it's very likely the United States will enter in a civil war situation in the next 2 to 4 years, especially after 2028 elections, when, you know, whoever wins, the other side just will not accept that person as the president. So I think the United States is going to go through a very tough period of imperial decline. So I think what's happening in Europe is one theater, but the real theater is within the United States. You know, if civil discontent erupts in the United States, then it will be very, very ugly because Americans are the most heavily armed people in the world.
Indeed. I mean, actually, it's an interesting point you've made because, again, as somebody who knows the history very well, because it is the history of my city, one of the things you find towards the end of the Peloponnesian War is that even as there is this internal crisis in Athens, Athenian decision making becomes increasingly irrational.
Yes.
And loses all contact with reality. Yeah. Yeah. And becomes unbelievably aggressive. I mean, it starts wars in all sorts of places until eventually Athens is basically fighting everybody, the Persians, the Sicilians, yeah. The Spartans, yeah. Its own allies. Yeah. It's fighting everybody yeah. at once. And so, as you rightly said, there's an internal crisis as well.
Yeah. So I love talking to you because you know so much about the Peloponnesian War. But yeah, the turning point in the war was actually the invasion of Sicily, right? So before then, it was not really a problem for Athens. It had the most dominant navy in the Mediterranean. But the Sicily expedition was completely pointless. No one knew why they were doing it. And it was very costly, not only that they lost all their soldiers in the expedition, but they'd also brought in Syracuse into the war. And Syracuse had a navy. Sparta did not have a navy. So Syracuse was down in the war, and that's what marked the downfall of Athens. So I think in the American situation, I think the downfall will be the irrational invasion of Iran. One of the biggest predictions is that eventually America will reach a point where it decides to launch a ground invasion of Iran. And I think it'll be exactly the same as what happened to the Athenians in Sicily. They go into Sicily and they win all these major battles at first, but then they're bogged down. They can't resupply their troops, and then their troops are forced to surrender against a superior Syracuse counteroffensive. I think we have a very similar scenario in the Middle East.
What is the risk that nuclear weapons could be used in these kind of scenarios? Because this is the fundamental difference between our situation today and the situation in the past. I mean, there were no nuclear weapons in the 5th century before Christ. I mean, they didn't exist then. So Athens might be going down, but it didn't have the option of using nuclear weapons. America, in theory, does. Is that a risk?
You know, I actually discount the use of nuclear weapons. I don't think nuclear weapons will be ever used. First of all, it's ultimate taboo, right? I mean, whoever uses nuclear weapons will be a pariah state for all of eternity, right? It doesn't matter who it is. If America uses it, then the entire world will turn against America, and America will be held in contempt for all of eternity. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is that we have to remember that even though these nation states are at war, they still have a lot of back channels. There's still negotiations going on. So remember, like even during the Peloponnesian War, Sparta and Athens, their elite were very close. They were intermarried with each other. And, you know, when Athens captured these Spartan hostages, the Athenians did return the hostages after some negotiations. So the war never descended into complete barbarism. I mean, there were gruesome engagements still in place. So even though Russia and the United States still at war with each other, they still have a lot of backdoor channel communications. Remember, what people don't recognize is that Putin and Trump are very good friends. And we know that from the meeting in Alaska and in Anchorage. If you just look at their body language, if you just look at their demeanor, their language, they're very close. They sort of have a rapport with each other. So I would discount actually the use of nuclear weapons. I do not think it's a factor in what will happen over the next 10 years.
Let's just pursue the Peloponnesian War analogy, which is an interesting one for me because obviously I'm Greek. Is Venezuela like the attack on Melos? Another action that Athens really didn't need to take, but it attacks Melos. Basically, it's starting to sense maybe that it's going down and things are starting to turn against it. But then it goes against Melos. It crushes this island state, which is trying to preserve neutrality and balance between the superpowers at the time, Sparta and Athens. And in doing so, it shocks the entire ancient world, the ancient Greek world. I mean, it's one of the things that turns attitudes against Athens. And of course, it leads Thucydides to do this incredibly powerful and extraordinary debate, which people always quote in many, many discussions. I mean, is this what the whole Venezuela thing is? Partly a demonstration again of power, an attempt to assert power and assert power in your own, what you claim to be your sphere of influence.
Yeah, so for me, Melos was a turning point in the war, because that's when Athens shed all pretense of hypocrisy, all pretense of liberalism, virtue, democracy, right? Might is right. That's what the Athenians said to the Melians. We can do whatever we want because we're stronger than you, and so just shut up and obey us. And the Melians said, we'd rather die. And the Athenians said, fine, then we'll just kill all of you, okay? So I think if I were to draw a historical parallel to Melos, I think it'd be more like Gaza or Palestine. Because, you know, the Gaza moment, that's when the entire world has given up hope in the United States. The Americans are clearly collaborators in what's happening in Gaza. And so I think the world is just disgusted with American supremacy, with American power. My understanding of Venezuela is different. I actually don't think the United States will launch a ground invasion of Venezuela. I don't think they have the appetite for it. I don't think they have the resources, the manpower, the political will to actually launch an invasion of Venezuela. What I think is happening there is actually a bit different. So let me tell you my analysis, and then you can respond. I think that right now there's a hidden war, in geopolitics, and the hidden war is between the nationalists versus the globalists. Another way of saying this is that Trump is taking on the global deep state. You know, the city of London, Wall Street, the deep state, who he thinks caused him to lose election in 2020. He still talks about how he was cheated in 2020. And who cheated him? The deep state, okay? So he sees his real enemy as a deep state. Okay, so if we do believe there's a global deep state, and there obviously is, how do they exercise power? Well, they exercise power by controlling three ways of generating immense profits, okay? The first is debt, okay, meaning finance and gambling, okay? The second is through slavery, meaning prostitution, human trafficking, that's the second thing. And the third thing is drugs, okay? So listen, going back to Chinese history, Britain did fight the opium wars in order to enforce drugs onto China, and it was actually profitable endeavor. And you create the entire global financial system off the opium wars. And so did that system go away? I don't think it went away. I think that if you just look at the city of London, it's still a money laundering operation. So if you are Trump and you really wanted to destroy the global deep state, if you really want to destroy the city of London, what you do is you attack what makes money, right? You attack their drug smuggling operations. So when Trump says that, you know, we're bombing these drug smugglers, and everyone's like, well, no, they're fishing vessels. I actually think Trump's telling the truth in this instance. I think they are actually bombing drug smugglers. And so they're trying to destroy the drug smuggling apparatus of the world. And that's possibly why they're talking about also intervention in Nigeria or wherever, okay? So I think that is actually the grand play here, to weaken the global deep state by destroying their money-making operations. So I don't think Trump will actually invade Venezuela. I think this all bluster, and I think that, but you'll see continual actions against drug smugglers around the world. That is what I think is going on.
That is very interesting. Can I just say, I live in London. I've lived here since the 60s.
Right, right.
The symbols of wealth created from the opium wars are everywhere. Many of the financial institutions in London that are so famous to this day, I'm not going to name them because that might lead to legal issues, but if you go back into their prehistory or their early history, you will find that a lot of it does come from that, from what happened, the opium wars and the trade in opium in China, which of course people in China remember extremely well. The British don't remember it anything like as well, just to say. That is interesting. Does that explain, however, this very strange story about fentanyl? And I'd like to bring in China now, because China is the colossus. I've always myself felt that in the end, everything that America does at the moment is ultimately about China. I don't know whether you agree with this, but that's certainly my own view, that the conflict in Ukraine, in Russia, in Iran, ultimately, if we come to that, it's all ultimately about China and about the challenge that Americans perceive as China posing. Where does this whole fentanyl thing come from then? Because I completely discount the idea that China is in fact involved in fentanyl smuggling. I think that makes no sense to me at all, and I've seen no evidence to support that claim. And yet it is endlessly repeated and widely believed, and Trump himself claims it, and he's posed tariffs on China in connection with it. How does that fit into what you've just been saying?
Yeah, so I think that the infrastructure, financial infrastructure you had for the opium wars is now underpinning all global drug trade, including fentanyl. So there are definitely Chinese nationals involved in fentanyl trade, but not the government, okay? The government would not support such an endeavor. So these are Chinese secret societies, Chinese criminal organizations that are producing some the precursor chemicals necessary, but it's a global network. And you're absolutely right in that most of the fentanyl smuggling is probably done by deep state actors like the CIA. Like I'm just guessing. I don't know. Okay, but because drugs are so profitable, you can imagine that multiple deep state actors are involved, and there's a lot of money laundering going around. I mean, it's a very sophisticated system that they have. And so, whether or not you whether you smuggle opium, whether you smuggle fentanyl, it's the same system.
Let's talk about China, because China is very different from the United States. I mean, the Americans are very, very busy all the time. They're very, there's almost feverish activity in the Middle East, activity in Europe, as we've just been discussing, activity in Latin America, in all sorts of places. China, by contrast, remains very, very calm and very still. Is this how China plays?
Yeah.
There's a friend of mine who is an academic, by the way, British academic, and he reminded me about, you know, the Chinese idea of, was it no action, the Taoist thing, that you remain still.
Yeah.
Can you discuss this?
Yeah. So I'm not sure if you had a chance to read Romance of the Three Kingdoms. That is the source of
absolutely.
Mold.
I have. I've got it over there. But
yeah. Yeah. So you know, Zhuge Liang is considered like the greatest military strategist in Chinese history, and he's able to foresee the future. The stratagems that he develops are just extremely sophisticated, extremely intricate. But what he did was he launched a series of invasions against his enemy. And all his enemy did was to sit back and let Zhuge Liang overextend and ultimately retreat. Okay, so that is the defining example of why it's important to let your enemy do all the work. Okay, because your enemy, if they do all the work, they're gonna make all the mistakes, and so you just sit back and you win. You just respond slightly to their maneuvers. So, you know, Zhuge Liang, he had all these strategies, he amassed all these forces. But, you know, when you actually move against an enemy, you're much more likely to make mistakes than you just sit back and defend. So that's the entire Chinese concept of geopolitics. Sit back and win.
Very, very, very different from the American and Western one. But let's just turn now to the events that are taking place, because we talked about Iran, we talked about Russia, we talked about the conflicts in these places. Is China going to be completely inactive in relation to them? Let's just look forward to an American invasion of Iran. And I agree, by the way, there are pressures for this. We've been talking about this many times. I mean, an attack, I still believe an attack on Iran is going to come at some point, maybe not this year as I once thought, but sooner or later it is going to come. And it's difficult to see how that is going to play out. But if there is an attack on Iran, what would China do? Would it just remain passive or waiting for the Americans to burn themselves out? Or would it take action, as it did in Korea, as it also did, of course, in Vietnam?
Right. So China right now is heavily reliant on Iran, right? Because China imports all of its oil and a third of its food. So if a war breaks out in the Middle East, then China is in a very, very unstable situation. Its economy could face collapse. So China would need to make preparations, and it would need to make contingency plans. Right now, the Chinese military is not equipped to fight wars overseas. It does not have a blue water navy. It has no experience fighting wars overseas. It doesn't have the supply lines, the logistics networks, the command and control centers to fight a war as far away as Iran. But I think that the Iranians have given assurance to the Chinese that Iran doesn't really need any help, right? Because let's just imagine what an actual invasion would look like. If Americans were to invade Iran, America could, in the first 4 weeks, occupy a great deal of Iran. America could knock out the air defenses. America could establish forward operating bases very, very quickly because the American military is equipped for shock and awe, for, you know, the blitzkrieg offensive. And there's very little that Iran could do to stop this sort of offensive. Once America is embedded in Iran, based on the topography, America would have a lot of issues with logistics, with resupply. And at this point, if Iran were to engage in a guerrilla warfare, using drones to strike at American supply lines, then the war's over. I mean, you've got 100,000, 200,000 American soldiers in Iran. They can't resupply. It's hard to reinforce them. And they're all spread out. And they have absolutely no sense of strategy. They don't know what to do. I mean, the war's basically over, right? So if this is a situation, I think this is the most likely scenario. What would China need to do in this sort of situation? What would Russia need to do? And Russia is going to overextend the United States in Ukraine anyway, right? Because while this war is happening, the United States is not going to leave Ukraine. It's still going to fight in Ukraine. And it's very likely that the United States is also engaged in a civil war at that point. There's all this domestic turmoil. So I'm not really sure what role China would play when America has chosen this path of self-destruction.
That's interesting because, again, I know a little bit about Iranian history. And, of course, this is an enormous country. I mean, again, I think people in the West underestimate the size of Iran and its complexity and the difficulty of its geography. And it's very, very mountainous. It's got great cities, but it's also a place where you could absolutely withdraw into the mountains. I mean, it's Afghanistan multiplied with enormously a much, much more sophisticated culture and a culture of resistance as well. Can I ask you about a discussion that grotesquely, comically incompetent European High Representative Kaya Kallas is supposed to have had with Wang Yi, who is China's foreign minister? This basically derives from a story that appeared in the South China Morning Post, but I'm not sure how reliable it is. But it's been widely circulated and publicized in Europe, which is apparently Kaya Kallas is alleged to have told Wang Yi, in apparently a difficult meeting that went on for hours and in which she lectured him about every conceivable thing, and in which even Wang Yi started apparently to become impatient over the course of the meeting. But anyway, she apparently asked him to put pressure on Russia to end the war in Ukraine on basically Western terms. And according to this claim that appears, Wang Yi responded that this is absolutely not what China is going to do, because doing that would simply set the scene for the West to come after China once they finish with Russia. Is this true? Or at least maybe, because we don't know. I mean, neither of us was there at the meeting. But do you feel that this could have been true?
So Americans are discussing a new military policy called strategic sequencing, right? Mm-hmm. So like, you know, let's end the war in Ukraine so we can move against Iran and then China, right? And then the Russians are like, well, then all that means is that you'll circle back to us eventually, right? So like, we're not going to agree to end this war in Ukraine. So, I mean, like, given the geopolitical landscape, Russia, China, and Iran are going to stick together because they know that if one of them falls, everyone else falls. It's all strategic sequencing. It's all seeing, like, you know, who they take out first so they can move on to the next target. So it sounds to me like a very plausible conversation. It seems to me the European envoy would be arrogant enough, silly enough, and short-sighted enough to make this sort of demand. And the Chinese response is very much in line with diplomatic protocol. China's going to abandon Russia so that it can be, you know, targeted later on. And right now, Iran, Russia, and China recognize that they need to stick together against the American Empire or they'll fall one by one.
The idea of strategic sequencing, which is becoming very widespread, as you rightly say, in American strategic circles, originates with a man called Aaron Wes Mitchell, who uses history in a very different way from the way that you do, Professor Jiang, and the way I do as well. And I don't think he understands history at all. But he is apparently a very close friend of Elbridge Colby,
right,
who is the Assistant Secretary of War, I presume we must now call him. And he is somebody who's particularly well known as a China hawk, and who basically does see things very much about conflict with China, which is the idea is you instead of taking on all your enemies at once, you take them on the assumption that they will not notice that what you're doing and that they won't respond, which is very strange. But anyway, bringing us back to this, though, Elbridge Colby, and this is basically my last question, by the way, for today, because we're no doubt going to have many conversations. But Elbridge Colby is now apparently talking about hemispheric defense, that the United States is overextended, that the game with China is in some way lost. There's been a new report by the RAND Corporation, which talks about trying to get to some kind of understanding with China, and that the United States needs to concentrate instead on defense of its own hemisphere, its own sphere of influence, North America and South America. And we've had talk about, you know, creating a new fleet, a special fleet with armored warships that are going to defend the hemisphere. Is there any prospect that that is indeed what the United States might do? I mean, it goes against all of the other trends that we are seeing for the United States to involve itself in lots of other places.
Yeah, so my gut reaction is that they're going to throw a lot of things at the wall and nothing's going to stick. Because right now, the American military bureaucracy is not capable of pivoting, of, you know, reprioritizing. They're kind of stuck where they are, which is to fight wars everywhere without any strategic objectives. So it gets involved in these silly wars, kind of extricate itself, and then it doubles down. And that's been the situation for a long time. And they feel as though they succeeded because remember, the American military industrial complex, it's a very corrupt institution that leeches off the nation state. So Julian Assange said it best. The point is not to have successive wars. The point is to have never ending wars. So I mean, I don't think people recognize the corruption in the American military complex, right? And again, the problem is America can feel no consequences for its for these disastrous wars overseas. So what if Europe falls? So what if America gets defeated in Iran? They'll just retreat back to the Continental Fortress. And, you know, the Western Hemisphere is completely self-sufficient. Worst case scenario, America just, you know, isolates itself in the Western Hemisphere, and it's not an issue for America. So America continues to make all these silly strategic mistakes. It is not capable of long-term strategic planning, and the corruption within the military is endemic. And there's really no way out for them.
I'm going to finish there, but just to add to that about corruption, because that is another major story in you can take from history. If we talk about Athens in the 5th century, corruption gets completely out of control there and starts to influence decision-making. And it also happens in Republican Rome. And by the way, it happens in Britain too.
Right.
Towards the end of the 19th.
So I don't offend you because you're an Athenian, but remember, once they start being corrupt, they never stop being corrupt.
No, that's it. It becomes the organizing principle around which all decisions ultimately end up being made. That is the reality of corruption, which I have seen. I've seen how it plays out myself. So I know all about that. Professor Chiang, you have been marvelous, if I may say. This has been a wonderful program. I'm going to stop now. What we like to do when we have, you know, our conversations and the conversation between myself and, well, yourself in this case, what we do is we allow a few minutes, about 15, 20 minutes maybe, for some of our viewers to put comments. And Alex, I'm going to, if you're right with that.
Thank you, Professor Chiang. Thank you. I've got the questions queued up. And on the corruption with Athens and with Greece, it never ends. That's for sure. We notice it today. So from Sahewa 100, multipolarity can be given a super boost if India and China bury their differences and focus on trade and investment. Alas, respective media for animosity. So India and China burying their animosity. What do you think about that, Professor?
Yeah, no, I think that it'd be wonderful if India and China were to come together. Unfortunately, there's a lot of historical animosity between the two. And also, there are some geopolitical realities that cannot be ignored. So, for example, the Tibetan Plateau provides fresh water to a lot of these Asian countries. And so there's always going to be some geopolitical rivalries between India and China. In fact, India would see China as the immediate geopolitical threat to itself. So I don't think that's something that can be papered over.
From Ivan Markov, I'm so happy to see Professor Chiang on the Duran. This is awesome. You need to watch his lecture on civilization. Definitely need to watch that lecture from Sahewa.
So guys, I did a lecture on Homer today, okay? So I don't like to prove myself, but you too will enjoy Homer, like my lecture on Homer. Yeah, I'm sure you read Homer, but you'll enjoy my take on Homer.
Fantastic lectures, by the way, on his channel. From Sahewa 100, Professor Chiang, what's the mood like in China? Do they feel like they want to back de-dollarization, support for the global south, rapprochement with India?
Yeah, so the mood in China, it's very complex. And especially after COVID, because remember, after COVID, the Chinese economy did take a major hit. Consumer confidence is not that high right now. So, you know, I think Chinese people just want peace in the world. Chinese are very much afraid of what's happening in Ukraine. They're very concerned about what could happen in the Middle East. So Chinese people are just praying for peace. They're praying for people to be more like Chinese people, reasonable, pragmatic, and willing to negotiate.
From Nikos, I hope Professor Chiang doesn't think Russia is weak because they move slow. According to Grok, Russia is considered a superpower, just not as big as China.
I think Russia is the most dominant military in the world right now. I don't think Russia is weak at all. So Russia is slow, but it's slow because they specialize in artillery warfare. And also, Russia wants to minimize civilian casualties as well as destruction of critical infrastructure, electricity grids, water supplies, because the Donbass, the Russians see Donbass as part of Russia, right? So Russia wants to govern Donbass after the war. So that's why Russia is being very methodical and slow in the process. So I don't think Russia is weak at all. In fact, I would say that given what's happened these past 4 years, Russia has proven itself to be the most dominant military in the world. I think that if NATO and the United States were to get together and fight Russia in Ukraine, then I would bet Russia would win.
From Chunky Monkey, if the AI bubble suddenly bursts and subsequently Trump presides over the collapse of the U.S. economy, what is the likely geopolitical impact?
Yeah, so that's a big concern right now, where the AI is clearly a bubble. It's overextended. It doesn't make any money. Like people don't recognize that ChatGPT, they don't make any money. In fact, they lose money hand over fist. And so it's very likely the bubble will pop. And I also think that it's very likely that the collapse will be engineered to create as much social chaos as possible. In other words, I think that social unrest will be instigated. And because if there's social unrest, then Trump can invoke the Insurrection Act. He can deploy the National Guard everywhere. So I think that what's happening in the United States is a very volatile situation. And you would think that given all this chaos in the United States would retrench, right? Would sort of like draw back from its foreign commitments. But, you know, if you study history, it's the complete opposite. If there's internal chaos, the empire lashes out overseas. So we're in for a rough ride.
From Fuzzy Balls, is the United States intentionally bankrupting as many European countries as possible to force them to get American loans and buy American bonds?
So that's a good question. I don't know if Americans are that clever, actually. I think it's just like Americans are just used to like doing things without any consequences. Remember back in World War I, the Americans were financing both the Bolsheviks as well as the right Russians because war makes money, right? And so they don't really foresee consequences. They really don't make, you know, long-term predictions. You know, I hate to say this. I went to Yale. I took a lot of political science course at Yale. These guys are not that bright, okay? The people who control the American foreign policy apparatus, they're not that bright. I hate to say that.
From Geo Stone, how would the world react if Venezuela are able to sink an aircraft carrier with a Russia or Chinese weapon? How would the U.S. ever recover?
I don't think Venezuela would ever do that. The United States would respond with nuclear weapons if that were to happen, because it'd be a tremendous loss of face for the United States. I think it's very unlikely that the United States actually launch a ground invasion of Venezuela. And if there's a ground invasion, then Venezuela would choose to fight a guerrilla war as opposed to like a kinetic war head on, because you would get totally destroyed by the American military if you were to do that.
From Mark Hewitt, people talk about the neocons, Rubio, Kellogg, whispering in his ear, but forget the influence of Susie Wiles acting as a gatekeeper for the neocons. What's your thought about Susie Wiles?
Absolutely. She, right now, the Trump camp is very much divided, right, between the American firsters and the neocons. And Susie Wiles, she has a notorious background. She is very close with the Zionists. She's very close with the military-industrial complex. And it seems as though she's able to manipulate things so that Trump's policies are aligned with the Zionists. I think she's very good at what she does.
All right, two more questions. Is that all right?
Absolutely.
Great. Yeah. Two or three more questions. From Jay Basin, what does the world look like past the special military operation?
So, again, I think that there'll be a showdown in Odessa. So I think Odessa will be the final battle. After Odessa, I see civil war, political collapse in Europe. I see Europe changing sides after new governments come in because they want this exploitation to end. They want these immigrants to leave Europe. But, you know, this timeline drags on, right? Because remember, Russia fights a war really slowly. An encirclement of Odessa would be a very drawn-out process. We don't know. It's hard for me to say what happens after Odessa. The big question for me is how long Putin can go on for, because Putin is really, in my mind, a strategic genius. He's able to foresee things far ahead. He's able to control a major event. He's a force of stability in the world. So I don't know what would happen if he were to leave the world stage. So that's my concern, actually.
Interesting. All right. From locals, our locals chat, from Jeffrey Brown. When Biden lets slip that China isn't going to eat your lunch, China is not a hegemonic aspirant power. And the former Australian Prime Minister Keating has basically said that China is our future economic partner here in Australia, above and beyond the US and the EU. What is our way forward in Australia to go against the narrative?
So, you know, China does not have geopolitical ambitions. You know, it doesn't have the sort of the Faustian spirit that the Westerners have, right? I mean, like Germany, England, America, these are all very Faustian countries that want to exert itself globally. China is very happy being China. China doesn't want to extend itself overseas. So China wants actually to be friends with everyone. It wants to be friends with Russia. It wants to be friends with the United States. It wants to be friends with Australia. So I don't know why Westerners are obsessed with this narrative that China is going to take over the world. Chinese aren't interested in taking over the world. Chinese are very interested in trading with everyone. It sees global trade as a source of both peace and prosperity. So China is very much interested in maintaining a current global order, one based on trade. So so if I'm Australia, then I would trade as much as possible with China.
And from Elza, Kallis quoted a Japanese think tank and told that opinion research in China show that the people don't support Russia in the SMO. I ask just for fun, is Kallis right?
Okay, she's right. So let me explain why. The Americans did something really, really clever, okay? In the 1980s, China was still close from the world. But during this time, what's really, really popular are these pirated DVDs showing these American movies. And Chinese would buy up these pirated DVDs and play it at home, okay? And for them, for Chinese, because this is right after the Cultural Revolution, right? These pirate DVDs represent a revelation. It was like the Bible to them. And it represented to like the promised land. And it sort of brainwashed them into thinking that America really is the promised land. And so there's always been this goodwill among ordinary Chinese towards America. I think it's a problematic belief. I think it's delusional. But America does soft power really well, okay? That's why America is able to get away with so much crap, because it has Hollywood, it has this popular culture that's been able to brainwash a lot of young people around the world, and it's been very effective in China.
Someone wants to know, Professor Chang, if you have lectures on the Civil War or on a future Civil War. I don't know, just it speaks about the Civil War. I guess maybe the future Civil War.
I do have a lecture specifically on that. So it's called the Second American Civil War, and it's on my channel. And it's part of my geostrategy lectures. And I think it's number 11. It's not geo, just you know, YouTube, just write down Second American Civil War, Predictive History, and you will see it.
All right. And one last one from Ronnie and Kiddo, a common question. The Second Athenian League partially revived the Dalian League for one last time, but not for long, ending the wars between Athens and its allies once again.
Yeah, I don't know that much about the Second Athenian League, but I do know that, you know, during the Peloponnesian War, Athens became corrupt, and it still had the greatest navy in the Mediterranean. It still had leading generals, really bright individuals, but it never really recovered the glory that it had during Pericles. So,
yep. All right. Alexander, anything well, to add to that?
Or? No, I
that was a fantastic life. Yeah.
It's the fourth century. It's after the defeat of Athens when Sparta becomes brutal and tyrannical and people feel that they have to come together around Athens again. Right. So it's part of that history, but it didn't last very long. And it caused all kinds of megalomania in Athens to come back and led to the disasters of the later fourth century. But this is a long historical topic to discuss some other time. I just wanted to say this has been an amazing program, and I think we've all enjoyed it hugely. And I think we've also learned an awful lot. And Professor Chang, let's do some more.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a lot of fun. I love talking about the Peloponnesian War. So to be able to talk it for this long, I'm very, very happy.
That was a fantastic live. Thank you so much for joining us. Predictive History, everybody, is the channel. It is in the description box down below. I will also add it as a pinned comment as well. Thank you, Professor Chang, for joining us on the Duran.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. All right, Alexander. Let's answer whatever remaining questions we have.
Absolutely.
A lot of good questions left.
Of course.
A fantastic live stream.
Absolutely.
Very, very interesting. Talking about the Peloponnesian War. Very interesting. All right, Haruko, thank you for that membership. Gifted 5 Duran memberships. I still can't figure out what that means, gifting memberships, but thank you. Let's see from Nikos. Alex, I hope you didn't go completely to Gilbert Doctaro's camp of nonsense. I see this recently. Doctaro's whining, Levan is whining, and others. There's another part. One second. I do agree with your criticisms of President Putin. He overinvested in Trump. He's trying to prevent the West from starting World War III and blowing us up. I watched Jim Jatris yesterday saying that Russia should strike a British base in Cyprus, and at the same breath saying that World War III might happen. A couple more parts, Alexander. I keep saying it to people, but no one is listening. What do you think is going to happen if Russia responds? They want that. They want to invade. The West is bankrupt. They need Russia's resources. And if they can't get them, they'll rather destroy the world. They'll be safe in their bunkers.
Well, an awful lot to unpack here. I mean, when I think Gilbert Doctorow has gone wrong is that I think that he imagines that there is a political challenge in Moscow to Vladimir Putin and to his position as president of Russia and as leader of the country. I don't see any sign of that whatsoever. I have been following first Soviet and then Russian politics since the time when I was at university, because that was what I studied. I studied American history, I studied Soviet history and Russian history. And I always retained an interest in this. And when there is a power struggle in Moscow, you can always see the signs. I mean, that they are very, very obvious to outsiders. There is nothing like that happening in Moscow now. And I think this is where, as I said, Gilbert Doctorow went wrong. That doesn't mean that there isn't debate and discussion, and sometimes quite heated argument. And I think there was a lot of arguments last summer ahead of the Alaska summit meeting between Putin and Trump. I think a lot of people in Moscow were saying to Putin, this meeting has not been prepared properly. We're already making concessions in advance of any commitments from the Americans, and we shouldn't be doing that. And I think as the weeks and months passed after Alaska, those arguments gained force in Moscow, and I think they're now pretty much in the ascendant. So I think we're past that period, actually. Now, just to say this, yesterday there was another meeting of the Security Council in Moscow, and we've had quite a lot of information about it. And it was very interesting because all of the big people were there, all the heavy hitters, apart from Lavrov for some reason. I think he's away. But anyway, all of the heavy hitters were there, Medvedev, Shoigu, Belousov, all of them. And they were all talking about
Gerasimov
was there. They were all talking about nuclear testing. And the point was, we don't understand what the Americans are up to. We don't understand whether we're supposed to take these comments of Trump seriously or not. But the consensus that everybody, including Putin, came to is that we can't disregard this. We've learned now our lesson that if the Americans start talking in this belligerent and confrontational way, it is likely to lead to something. And the Russians took a first major step towards preparing for the possibility of the resumption of nuclear tests. So I think this debate has been resolved. And it was very interesting to see how Putin handled the entire discussion, because he didn't at any point talk about diplomatic outreach, my friend Donald, any of that sort of thing. There was no hint of it in this discussion yesterday. So I think we now have a consensus that has developed in Moscow, essentially, if you like, within the people who won the argument are the hardliners. And I think this is now, if I can call them hardliners, the realists, perhaps, or the skeptics, maybe, might be the best word of all. They've won. I think even Putin has come round to this. And the Russians have made it absolutely clear after that meeting yesterday that if there is a resumption of nuclear testing by the United States, Russia will be there. It will resume testing itself, and that will be the end of any possibility of any kind of detente or rapprochement or return to nuclear arms control between the Russian and American superpowers. This is a topic which Alex and I are definitely going to discuss in more detail in a more dedicated program.
We touched upon this in a video last week as well, Alexander, and how a lot of Trump's moves are there to emulate, to mimic what Reagan did during the Cold War.
Yes.
In the belief that this is going to bankrupt Russia, another nuclear type of arms race is going to bankrupt Russia.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Which is, by the way, a misunderstanding, a misjudgment of what Reagan was actually doing. As people who worked with Reagan, people like Chas Freeman, the ambassador whose name I've just forgotten, the one who was in Moscow at that time, people who actually worked with Reagan are constantly trying to explain and point out that Reagan did not seek confrontation with Moscow in the way that people think he did. On the contrary, he always wanted to work finally towards peace agreements with the Russians, and that the end of the Cold War was successfully negotiated on that basis.
Yeah. Nico says, so either Russia will absorb the blows, faith in Putin will diminish, and he'll be replaced by another guy willing to respond, or he responds himself. Either option leads to nuclear war. But go ahead, push back on everything I said. It's not like we are dealing
with
sociopaths that say this openly.
I don't think so. I think what will happen, again, I don't think that the demand in Moscow was for Russia to start taking very aggressive steps on the battle, against the United States, blowing up carriers and attacking bases in Cyprus and doing those kind of things. I think the point that the argument was much more calibrated. Why are we making concessions about ceasefires in Kherson region and Zaporozhye? Why are we engaging Trump in these long discussions and negotiations when ultimately they're not going to lead anywhere? What we're doing instead is we're putting ourselves in a false position where we're making concessions or appearing to make concessions, which will simply lead to further demands. Let's stick to the policy that is succeeding now, which is fighting the war and winning it. And that's what we should do. So I don't think, to repeat again, there is no evidence of any attempt in Moscow to overthrow Putin. I think everybody in Moscow understands that a political crisis at this time in a war, acting against a massively popular and widely respected leader inside Russia, a leader who also is widely respected around the world, who's a friend of Xi Jinping, who's a friend in Narendra Modi, that this would be a catastrophic mistake. And besides, all of the people who we're talking about, Medvedev, Shoigu, Belousov, Gerasimov, they're all loyal to Putin. There's no sign, as I said, that there is a crisis of that kind in Moscow. But that doesn't mean that they always agree with what he thinks and does. They're not yes men. That's the difference. Mm-hmm. Between the Russian government and some of the governments that we see in other places.
Yeah, and Putin can say, you know, we tried everything with Trump.
Exactly.
We exhausted all our options. We tried everything, and we still got sanctions, and we still got a return to demanding a ceasefire.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Bobby Jane, welcome to the Durant community. SCG, welcome to the Durant community. Matthew says, how can Europe even contemplate a war? It has absolutely nothing to fight with, and the people hate the leaders.
You know something, in any rational world, I would completely agree with you. Listen to the people who lead Europe today. Do they strike you as being rational? Do they strike you as being connected to reality? Because they don't come across that way to me. Once upon a time, not very long ago, actually, I assumed that realism would ultimately prevail in Europe. And I was completely wrong about it. Now I look at them. I look at Kaya Kallas. I listen to Ursula von der Leyen. My God, God help me. I listen to Emmanuel Macron. These people have completely lost touch or connection to reality. They inhabit their own bubble, and they are always working each other up and pushing each other to ever more extreme outcomes. Gerhard Schroeder, the last man who was a proper German chancellor, gave testimony to a investigation that's been carried out by the state of Mecklenburg about Nord Stream pipelines. And I haven't watched it, but I've managed to get quite a lot of indications about what happened. And the sanity and rationality of Schroeder as compared with everyone else, I think put everyone to shame. From what I could tell, he didn't give an inch. And they all came out sounding and looking hysterical and ridiculous.
Sanjeva says, two thumbs up for Alex and Alexander. Thank you, Sanjeva, for that. Jungle Jin says, is predictive history based on or related in concept to Isaac Asimov's idea of psycho history from his Foundation series? Best place to find out more?
I suppose so. I mean, I think Asimov, if I have to be frank, took it much too far. I think that he probably took the view that, you know, you can actually look at the past and assume that what happened in the past is also going to happen again. There's a very, very famous novel in English novel, which the very first line is that the past is another country. People do things differently there. And I think that's something one always has to remember. We are not 5th century Athenians, but we can nonetheless learn a lot from what 5th century Athenians did.
Aquidus 1907 says, Alex, please invite Simon Dixon. He has the most insightful and comprehensive view of world geopolitics that I've heard in the last 4 years. Eye-opener and a big aha moment.
Okay, good. Yeah, yes.
Definitely. Thank you for that recommendation. Gonzo420, welcome to the Durant community. Chunky Monkey says, is it plausible that Putin is a billionaire?
No, I can tell you for an absolute fact that he isn't. And I can say this conclusively because about a couple of years ago, I actually did a massive investigation of my own, trying to get to the bottom of how rich a man Putin really is. And I came to the conclusion that he's not rich at all.
Zizi Karayanis, thank you for that super sticker. From Matthew, will the Russians respond to storm shadows outside of Ukraine?
Well, I don't know, possibly. But I mean, we'll see what will happen. And we will see what the United States actually does. I mean, you mustn't put any reliance on anything that Trump says. But for the moment, he seems to be veering against missile strikes against Russia. I think Putin gave him a very, very strong warning about this. And for the moment, at least, he seems to be heeding it.
Mirjana, thank you for that super sticker. From Gonzo420, stellar show. From Jai Basin, is it possible that Trump will face criminal charges for the extrajudicial killings as it has come to light? Two people survived the attack. How could the U.S. attack be anything other than terrorism? Upside world sucks.
I know a lot of people are talking about this, including some people in the military. I don't myself believe it's ever going to happen. I mean, if we're talking about criminal prosecutions of the United States against politicians, they are invariably based on the kind of things that we have seen. They're reflections of political struggles within the United States. I think that the political class in the United States will never prosecute one of its own, even someone like Trump, because of violence committed overseas. It's never going to happen.
Eric Hatchett, thank you for that super chat. Chunky Monkey says, why does Alex call Zelensky Zelensky? Because he banned the Z. That's why.
Indeed.
He banned the Z way back in the beginning of the SMO. He banned the letter Z. Mark Hewitt says, after Mamdani's win, do you expect an exodus from New York? How would that affect the U.S. long term?
Well, who knows? I, by the way, am very underwhelmed by Mamdani. I've listened to him. I don't think he's going to amount to very much, actually. I don't think he's going to change very much. He's going to make things worse in New York. Of that, I'm confident, by the way. I don't think he's somebody who's going to be very interested in doing much that will really improve the situation in New York at all. And I don't think he'll be there very long. The mistake people will make is if they react to him in such a way that it makes him look like a more important and national figure than he properly or truly is. That's my own view about
them. Which they already are.
Which they already are. I mean, they're already making that.
They can't help themselves. Yeah,
they can't help themselves.
Fuzzy Ball says, of course, the United States is not going to invade Venezuela with 16,000 troops after they gave Russia, China, and Iran a 30-day heads up so they could send weapons and defense systems and set up a defense.
I wouldn't be so sure.
From Jim, is Poseidon a game changer?
Yes, it is. I actually had an email from somebody who is somebody who has knowledge about these things, and this person thinks that Poseidon is an even bigger changer, a much bigger changer than the Buda Vesnik is. So it's untrackable and effectively indestructible, and there is no obvious counter to it.
Jungle Jin says Trump will not be prosecuted for actions as president, as the SCOTUS has given blanket indemnity to presidential actions.
Well, there you go.
Jamila says the United States is a leader in killing Christians around the world, but now Trump cares about Nigeria. Please speak about it. Thank you, Alexander and Alex.
Well, I think we need to discuss the whole situation in Africa altogether. But you're absolutely correct about this. I mean, in the sense that the United States has this unbelievably selective approach to human rights violations. So Christian communities across the Middle East, as we know, have been absolutely annihilated. They've been destroyed in Iraq. for example, the Assyrian church, I mean, it's been driven out of existence. Nobody seems to care. Suddenly we discover the plight of Christians in Nigeria. We discover persecution of Christians when it suits us.
Mr. J4616 says, this is the equivalent of seeing my favorite cartoon character in another cartoon that I liked as a kid. Thanks, you all. Thank you for that. Let's see. Nikos says, and since you are talking about China today, they and India are hypocrites. They play it tough now while they condemned the SMO and stopped buying oil.
Well, I don't think they have stopped buying oil. First of all, if we're talking about China, China and Russia just had a major economic summit. Of course, it's received absolutely no attention. I mean, you get anonymous comments appearing in Bloomberg about how Chinese refiners are not buying Russian oil. And the meeting between the Russian prime minister in Beijing, leading a huge economic delegation, and the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, that gets no attention at all. I mean, it's a good example, if you like, of the extraordinarily distorted news flow that, as I said, these anonymous things from who knows whom get attention. And, you know, a major economic summit gets none. Anyway, over the course of this meeting between Xi Jinping and Mishustin, they agreed that they would enhance and accelerate cooperation, including specifically in energy. So I don't think China is stopping purchases of Russian oil. I think, on the contrary, it's more likely over time to ramp them up. As for India, I think they're more vulnerable. And I think that they are doing all kinds of maneuvers. But the Indian Oil Corporation, which is a state-owned entity, has, in fact, bought oil from Russia. It's done advanced contracts buying oil from Russia in December, which is after the Lukoil Rosneft sanctions come into play. So it looks as if India is going to continue to buy Russian oil also. And there's been a whole slew of announcements in Russia and India about new economic and industrial deals between India and Russia. And of course, Putin is going to India in a few weeks' time.
Sir Muggs Games says, after seriously pissing off 800 officers, Trump wants to launch a military operation. I'm sure his plans have been leaked to everyone everywhere.
I wouldn't be surprised. I'm sure you're right, actually.
Yeah. Samuel Maroni says, does Russia have rare earths?
Yes.
Has it an industry?
Yes. It, of course, in the Soviet times, it absolutely did. It had to. My understanding is that it's been massively run down, like much else, after the Soviet Union collapsed. They now have a program to revive it. We'll see what comes.
All right. Fuzzy Ball says, you don't have to read my last super chat joke. Let me find that super chat. Fuzzy Ball's 1 second. Zariel says, I disagree. Asimov's node, as well as most historical academics, the deal in cycles will attest to, it's not predictive or psychological. It's just what it is, cycles. Even the Bible quotes nothing new under the sun.
Oh, sure enough. Nothing new under the sun, indeed. But as I said, where I think people can sometimes go wrong is if they make it a little bit too much like a sort of statistical science. And there, I think you need to be a little careful. But that's not what Professor Chiang does, by the way, just to make that clear.
Klaus says, the Russians fear a false flag where the Ukrainians, together with NATO, are creating a new Chernobyl in Zaporozhye. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely right. But the Russians have been extremely on top of the possibility of false flags from very early on in the special military operation. They warned about them many times.
Nico says, who would have thought we'll have a communist mayor in New York, but instead of the hammer and sickle, he wears the pride flag like a true neo-Marxist.
Well, he can't be a communist because he also says that he's a Muslim. and Islam and communism, at least of the Marxist-Leninist variety, are completely incompatible with each other. I simply make this point because I think we should use words like communist and indeed Marxist. I think we should use them correctly. He is a socialist of an extremely threadbare kind, as far as I'm concerned. Having, as I said, once been that myself, I should know.
He's a rapper, too.
He's a rapper as well, exactly. Monkey. I mean, he's clearly a leftist. I mean, of that, there is no dispute at all. But, I mean, he's the kind of leftism that he's going to engage in is going to be absolutely chaotic, utterly destructive, and it's going to discredit leftism even further in the United States, including amongst the people of New York, just to say.
Monty 1054 says, yes, the American military industrial complex is corrupt, but why is that so? Is it because it's become the American rentier class's main cash cow?
Yes, I think so. I think also there is something else. And here I'm going to say something which I suspect some people might disagree with. But I think that another reason is that the American military industrial complex was grafted onto an American polity that really wasn't structured for it. I mean, America was not about a 19th and early 20th century America was not about having military industrial complexes or even large militaries. I mean, if you go back into the early 19th century, they were all about militias in those days. So America has never really had the culture to do big arms production on a continuous basis, not just, you know, for war like the Second World War, but, you know, as an institution of the United States, a permanent institution of the United States. That was never really what it was shaped for.
Fuzzy Balls, I think I found the chat that you're referring to. It's the one with Dick Cheney. Okay, I will pass over that chat then. It is a good good joke. Let's see. John Ski says, if Taiwan belongs to China, then Cuba belongs to the US, to the USA. The Falklands belong to Argentina and Cyprus belongs to Turkey.
Well, I'm not going to get into a discussion of this, but why do you say that? I mean, when has Cuba ever been part of the USA? I mean, when has Falklands, I mean, I'm not sure about Falklands, I'm not going to get into that, but Cuba has never, as far as I know, been a part of the USA. Until the 1890s, Taiwan was absolutely part of China. And I don't think any that's contested, actually. And the government of Taiwan still claims, by the way, officially, that it is the actual government of China. Just so.
Gonzo 420, thank you for that super chat. John Ski says Cheney and McCain are embracing in the underworld.
Okay. Probably.
Iranian Kiddo says Macedonia garrison was stationed there for a few years and Athens permanently lost its navy and had to return Samos to the exiled Samians.
You're completely right. You have a profound knowledge of ancient history. I've said this before, Iranian Kiddo. I am very, very impressed. As somebody who was brought up in it, I am extremely impressed.
Nikos says, what do you think is the solution? Do you think with his recent interviews and actions, President Putin is respected again? Will the dissent continue?
Oh, I think he's always been respected. As I said, I mean, any political system that has the ability to conduct dissent, to have a conversation with itself and even an argument and then come to a consensus and a decision is a healthy system. A system where everybody is obliged always to agree with everybody is a system that is certain to decay. I don't think this should be taken as a sign of crisis. It's a sign, on the contrary, that government in Moscow works an awful lot better than government in any Western country at the present time.
Jungle Jin says, speaking of Africa, Biafra is re-emerging as a major issue in Nigeria.
Interesting.
Vincent says, Alexander, how would you rate the quality of life in London now? I have never been, and I'm trying to determine whether it is some sort of dystopian globalist future or actually a cool city. Thanks.
Right. I have seen some of the reports about London, which I think do greatly exaggerate the situation here. I mean, we are not, this is not a dystopian place. I mean, it is not the hellhole that some people are saying. I mean, mostly it remains a great city with tremendous things that happen, and most parts of it are safe and things of that kind. And you know, I do want to say that. I mean, it's still a great city. It is got accumulating problems, including social problems, which are getting worse and worse, and which are not being managed properly. But it is certainly a place which I still believe it is worth visiting and seeing, and one should come here without fear.
Iranian Kato says, Athens became so powerful as a direct result of the Persian Wars. It was, in fact, during this time in the 5th century BC when a collective Greek identity was developed among city-states to counter Persia.
Correct. Entirely true.
Sir Muggs Game says, Trump is America's Zelensky, TV actor elected for peace, but winds up extorting friend and foe for money, money, money. Two peas in a pod.
Unfortunately, those parallels have some weight behind them that you're making.
Chunky Monkey says, why did Ukraine's terrorist attacks stop?
Have they? Have they stopped? I mean, I'm not aware that they've stopped. As far as I'm aware, they continue. Just about 2 weeks ago, Zelensky gave instructions that they should be intensified. I mean, what might have changed is that the Russians might be more successful in countering them. And I have heard reports about this, but I don't get the sense that there's been any change in policy or direction on the part of Ukraine, or at least the Zelensky government.
Iranian Kato says, taxes collected from city-state made Athens extremely wealthy. Yeah. Parthenon was largely built using funds collected from other Greek city-states for mutual defense against Persia.
Correct.
Nikos says, I do research in Grok like the multipolar superpowers. I found out that Greece is the sixth most stressed and depressed nation in 2025. How do we live?
Oh, dear. Well, I haven't been to Greece for 2 years now. Alex knows it better than me, I suppose.
How do we live? It's a good question, Nikos. Yeah. How do we live? Sir Muggs Game says, Hey, Orban, you should have known that the wheels on the bus go round and round and round and round.
Well, I have to say, one of the most ruthless and cynical things that I've seen over the last couple of weeks is this way in which Trump has thrown Orban under a bus. I mean, it appalls me, actually.
They'll be meeting in D.C. and Trump will flip-flop to a different position and then he'll flip-flop.
Eventually. Exactly. Yeah. But Orban must now know that he cannot trust Trump.
Exactly. Gonzo 420 says, thanks for covering the financial side of the wars. It's all extremely interesting. Thank you, Gonzo, for that. Sir Muggs Game says, has anyone seen Mandami and Jolani in the same room?
Interesting question. Yeah.
Fuzzy Ball says, Lindsey Graham is 2025's Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
Very true. Sir Muggs Game says, in the finale, this says it all. Allo apotin Vavolina ke allo apotin Parthenona. All right. Thank you for that. Iranian Kiddo says, Poseidon, the great god, mover of the earth and the deep unharvested sea, O shaker of the earth, tamer of the horses, savior of the ships, the girdler of the earth, O blessed one, do thou befriend the mariners.
Absolutely. One of the most powerful of all the gods. And, a Poseidon earth shaker, exactly as you say.
Matthew says,
God of the earth, god of earthquakes as well, by the way.
A beautiful temple in Sunio as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Beautiful place to visit. Yes. Matthew says, will this all stop short of nuclear war? Will this all
stop? I think so. I agree with Professor Chiang here. I think that in the end, people will draw back, governments will draw back, and they will avoid doing it. At least the great powers will avoid doing it. And I firmly remain of the view that within the militaries, including the US military, rational people continue to be in charge of the nuclear weapons. I mean, there's some very unbalanced people within the American military today, but the people who are responsible for nuclear weapons, whom I have heard and seen, strike me as being extremely clever, intelligent, wise people.
Jay Basson says, does Zelensky actually know what is happening on the battlefield, or is he deliberately misleading the West and the people of Ukraine? His comment about 60 Russian soldiers was breathing for I.
Absolutely. It was an extraordinary statement, actually. I think there's a bit of both in this. I think he is obviously misleading everybody. I mean, there is that is, shall we say, 80% of it. But I think 20% is delusion as well. The writing is on the wall, but he doesn't want to read it. So he closes his eyes and fantasizes as well. But 80% of it is deception.
Never forget, he's an actor.
Yeah.
He's an actor, and he's misleading people. But he's also starting to believe his role, his own lies.
That puts it very well.
Yeah. Julian Smith says, Alexander, are you able to clarify why Mamdani cannot be both Muslim and Marxist communist?
Because the two are completely incompatible. Marxism is a materialistic ideology that denies the existence of the supernatural and ultimately God. So how can you be a Marxist and a Muslim at the same time? I know many people try, but anybody who has a proper understanding of Marxism, and by the way, I should say I studied Marxism, and I've had many friends who've been Marxists, and I've actually known absolutely real, genuine communists. Anyway, I can tell you for an absolute fact that their perspective is a purely and completely materialistic one.
Nico says, and Alex, when you are in Greece, come in Haidari, sit in Polataki, so I can come and say hello to you in person. We can greet Alexander together.
Absolutely.
Consider it done, Nikos. Yeah, consider it done. Iranian Kiddo says, during the Mycenaean era, Poseidon was the most supreme deity in parts of the Peloponnese, even more important than Zeus, particularly in Thebes, Pylos, and Arcadia, based on linear B tablets found there.
You are absolutely right, again. And I should know, because of my aunt, who was Minister of Culture, I got to know an awful lot of the Greek archaeologists, and I remember them telling me exactly this.
And Iranian Kiddo says, Arcadia in central Peloponnese is where god Poseidon's cult lived, and they believe Poseidon was born there. Cult of Despina was also in Arcadia. Despina was the epitaph they used for Persephone, daughter of Zeus and Demeter, niece and wife of Poseidon.
Absolutely. Well, can I just say, Arcadia, you're all right about all of that, and Arcadia is as beautiful, the landscape there is as beautiful as people imagine it to be. It is really extraordinary. It's perhaps the place in Greece that I find the most lovely.
Fuzzyball says, if one day you hear the Europeans praise me, know that I have betrayed you. Samora Machel, former president of Mozambique.
Wow.
Monty 1054 says, how do you see the Europeans reacting to Russia reaching Odessa? Will they really get involved militarily themselves? Will Europe really collapse?
We will see. But if they do decide to intervene, it would not surprise me. I think if it was up to Emmanuel Macron, he would definitely do it.
Philip Pinier, thank you for that super chat. Elza says, Alex, you said that stealing Russian assets scares investors, but isn't the freezing already a reason not to invest in the EU?
Well, yes. I mean, but actually seizing it is a further step beyond that. And if you start doing that, if you are actually confiscating, outright stealing people's assets, then that is a further crossing of an even brighter red line. And I think that will shake and alarm people around the world. Apparently, Saudi Arabia is constantly telling the Europeans, don't even think of doing this thing. And it is having an effect, apparently. I mean, it's one of the reasons why France, which has many Saudi investments, has up to now opposed this thing.
Yeah. Iranian Kiddo says, theory is that the Dorians migrated south to the Peloponnese in the late Bronze Age, led to the Greek Dark Age. Mountainous Arcadia held out against the Spartans, who were of Dorian origin. They preserved their Mycenaean culture for longer.
Yes, there is a lot here. I have to say there is a lot of argument and debate about amongst the archaeologists about what really did take place and whether there ever was a Dorian invasion. I'm not going to pretend I know this, so I'm going to give a bastard to this part for your discussion.
And Iranian Kira says Cypriot Greek dialect is believed to be closely related to ancient Arcadian dialect.
Yes, I've heard that too. It's a particularly ancient dialect, very ancient indeed.
And on that note, Alexander, I think we've got all the questions answered. And that was a great live stream.
Well, absolutely was.
Final thoughts?
Well, it was a phenomenal live stream, and what an erudite one. And a different from the ones we do, but also very closely related to the kind of discussions we have.
Absolutely. All right. So I have Professor Jang's information in the description box down below. I will also add his channel information as a pinned comment. I definitely recommend everyone follow Predictive History, which is a fantastic channel. Thank you to everyone that watched us on Odyssey, on Rockfin, Rumble, YouTube, and a big shout out to our locals community, the Duran.locals.com. You can also find us on Substack as well. Alexander is writing articles exclusive to Substack and to Locals. So definitely check out those articles from Alexander. Hopefully I can also put together some articles in the future, but all the videos also go up on both those communities. So that's it. We should get back to work, Alexander, and put out some videos, huh? Thank you to our moderators as well, by the way. Thank you to Harry and Zariel and Peter and Reckless Abandon as well. I think I got the moderators for today. I hope I got all the moderators for today. For some reason, my chat is not scrolling, so I can't see everybody in the moderator list. Let's put up some videos, Alexander.
Indeed, sir.
Two more. From Sir Mugs Game, to be fair to Trump, I think he always pulls the rug from under Rear Admiral Lindsey Graham. Thank you for your service, Senator. And Iranian Kiddo says, coincidentally, the first Hellenic polytheist temple in 1700 years opened in Arcadia just this past March. This news truly made me happy.
Oh, goodness. Okay, I didn't know about this.
And Alexander Dirge says, time flies. Yes, it does.
It certainly does.
And from Iranian Kiddo, the Dorian invasion theory is now dismissed, but historians now believe Dorians simply settled there.
Right, okay. As I said, I'm not an expert on this at all. That is too close to archaeology and not close enough to the kind of literary records-based history with which I'm more familiar.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Take care.
Take care.